Okay, this is Kelly Roop. Today is Monday, November 22nd. I am at Outreach, Madison's Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Community Center with Steve Starkey for our second interview. So Steve, just to follow up on something that you had mentioned last time, during our first interview, you talked about when you were younger and you described yourself as politically radical, and I was just hoping you could share a little bit more of what that actually meant, maybe some things that you did that you would describe as mm-hmm. politically radical.
Okay. Well, I grew up in a family. Both of my parents are working class, and both of them came from farm families. And my earliest political kind of education or, you know, information that I got politically had to do with my grandfather. And he was a New Deal Democrat. He during the Depression, worked for WPA, building roads, and was very big fan of Franklin Roosevelt, and, you know, saw that under that administration the country went from being bankrupt to getting back on its feet, and, you know, and he was also very very much in favor of, you know, kind of the working class, working man's rights and unions, and, you know, that kind of thing. He was a poor farmer, self-educated. I think he went through the eighth grade, but really smart and really well-educated. I remember he told me one time that he read every book in the library, in his local library, so he had to start going to another town so that he could use another library because, you know, there weren't enough books for him. So that was kind of the beginning of my political thinking. And, it, you know, we've visited my grandparents a lot. They live near Elroy, and I lived in Baraboo when I was a little kid, so it was only about an hour. And so we visited there a lot, and he was always talking about politics and the government and the latest news, and he was very much up on politics and a very staunch Democrat. So that was kind of the beginning of my political education. And then, you know, I was in high school. I guess the Vietnam War happened when I was in grade school and junior high. So that was, you know, something that really affected the nation. And another thing was the civil rights movement was going on in the 60s. The 60s was a really, you know, a lot of radical new things happening, you know, politically and socially. And so I was a product of that generation. And so, you know, there was also the hippie movement and Woodstock and all that stuff that happened. And so I think I was really strongly affected by that. I remember when I was in high school, I grew up on the west side in Madison, and a very white neighborhood, kind of a, you know, I don't know, middle class to upper middle class white neighborhood. And we had neighbors that was a black couple, and they, at least the woman worked for the university. Her husband was a businessman. And, you know, it was very different to have the only black, I think they were the only black family that lived in that whole side of the town, you know, and that was back in the day when, guess who's coming to dinner, you know, it was very, having kind of multiracial kind of neighborhoods was a very big deal. And this woman happened to be a member of our church, and she took a big group of people from our church down to Milwaukee to visit ghettos in Milwaukee, and see poverty there and visit black churches there. And, you know, I met Father Grappi, when Father Grappi was really active in the civil rights movement, and there was a lot politically going on and socially going on in Milwaukee. So that was kind of some of the really early influences. And I did protest the Vietnam War. There was a lot of there were peaceful demonstrations that I remember a candlelight march that went down State Street, and I remember when we got to it started, I think, on University. We got to the bottom of State Street there by the Library Mall, and there were candles going all the way up to the square. I mean, it was like, miles long the march was. But then there were also some protests that became very confrontational, and there was violence, and so I was never part of smashing windows or doing anything like that, but I did go to lots of protests about the war back then. So that was kind of, like the earliest part of my radical politics, and out of that anti-war kind of protests and civil rights came women's rights movement and the gay, the gay movement all came out of that kind of period. So there was I have my politics hasn't changed that much from when I was in high school. I think that the really early experiences shaped my political thinking for the rest of my life. And I think now, back in the day, in the 60s and 70s, it was more about take to the streets and march and protest and, at times, parts of the community also were involved in riots or, confrontations with police and stuff like that. I didn't get into that, but it was much more of a rebellion kind of thing. And now I think I more work within the system, work with nonprofit organizations, work to support politicians, work on legislation, etc., to try to change things, and not as much revolutionary, but the goal and the politics are still the same.
Well, tell us a little bit then about some of the projects that you've been involved with, whether that's with organizations or personally. I mean, I don't know how you did it, but what projects have you worked on?
Well, in the 70s, I lived at a housing co-op in Madison, Summit Avenue Co-op. And I lived there through a lot of my college years. It was very interesting. It was a big old frat house. And we had like 20 people living there on a regular basis. It was kind of anywhere from late teens to early 40s, mostly students, but some people were just living there and hanging out and working. I guess kind of a hippie culture, more or less, roughly. It was probably left of center politically. But that affected me a lot, learning how to live with in a co-op house with 20 other people. Very interesting. And also during that time, and kind of because of living in that situation, I worked for food cooperatives, but it wasn't there was a co-op that was kind of a distributor for all the smaller co-ops like Mifflin Street and Willie Street, but it was a bigger wholesaler. And our co-op had to put in so many hours a month, and we all had to do a certain number of work hours for the house. So that was one of my jobs, was working at that co-op warehouse. And I think I also put in hours at Mifflin Street. So it was involved in food co-ops and in housing co-ops in the 70s, and then also kind of radical politics. But that was, And I was I also worked for the main course restaurant, which was kind of a vegetarian collective restaurant that was at the 306 North Brooks. It used to be the YMCA on campus there. It was there for probably at least a decade. So those were some of the early projects that I worked on. I came out in 1981, and I had a boy. One of my very early boyfriends was a college student. He was from Boston, and he and a friend of his, who was also in school here at the UW, decided that they were going to create the first state gay newspaper for Wisconsin. When we first started, it was just to be a local paper, and it was actually affiliated with the United, which is the predecessor organization of Outreach. And later we decided that it wasn't just like a newsletter of the United. It was really a newspaper that was for the whole community and statewide rather than just local and a newsletter. So it kind of evolved into a statewide. And that was called Out Newspaper. We formed in 1981, and I think in 1982 we really kind of went statewide and went on our own and became, separated from the United and became a real official organization. And we published monthly statewide. We had a distribution network that put our newspapers in communities from, Superior to Racine. And it was kind of a labor of love. There wasn't a lot of money involved, although we did, we gathered enough resources so that we could pay to distribute, to print and distribute 10,000 papers a month. And I think the goal in that was, at that time, in the early 80s, there was no gay culture. I mean, the only gay culture was a few bars. It was maybe a couple bars in Madison, a couple bars in Milwaukee, and that was the only anything gay that existed. There was no businesses, there was no social groups. It was very, very, under the radar. And so our idea was that it was a kind of community building effort. In other words, that if people knew about other gay people or other gay activities or things or news or culture that was happening, it would start to create community and connections with people, and it did. And we published, it was not what they now call a bar rag, which is mostly about entertainment and sports and bars and that kind of thing. It was really more of a political newspaper, and it was really more about content. I mean, there was a lot of editorial content. It was not just, photos or ads, although we did have advertising so that we were to help us pay for our distribution. But we started out with just Brooks Edgerton, and he was the editor, and my boyfriend Peter was the kind of publisher. He did kind of everything to make the paper happen, and Brooks wrote it, and the rest were volunteers, and we developed into a collective of I think five people that were working on the paper. And it was the kind of deal was we only paid minimum wage, so they were half-time positions because you had to work half-time somewhere else in order to be able to support yourself. It gave you a little bit of pin money to be able to, to cobble together your rent or whatever. But I think we had like an advertising manager and a business manager and an editor. And I was, I did production, which meant everything, from getting the paper typeset to the printer and back and distributed and all of that stuff in a halftime position. And so that was very challenging, but it was also very interesting. And there was a very strong camaraderie and relationship and little community that developed around that paper. We published for 5 years from monthly, from 82 through 87. And then the people in and eventually we had like a contingent in Milwaukee that developed. And I think there was a writer and or a couple of writers and some distribution people down there. And what happened was the Madison group kind of all burned out. Many of them had been working on the paper for 5 or 6 years, you know, from its inception. And they were either, you know, their lives were changing, they graduated from school, they were moving away, they, you know, needed to get a full-time job. Brooks got a job at a full-time at the Capital Times. And so we all said at the same time, we can't do this anymore. We were still, we weren't in debt, and we were still, you know, earning enough money to be able to keep the paper going, but we were all just kind of burned out. And so it turned out that the Milwaukee contingent decided to take over, and they kind of reshaped the paper, and they renamed it. It was called the Wisconsin Light, and that paper, I believe, printed for another 11 years or something like that after. So that, you know, the two parts of that entity went on for almost two decades. So that was really cool, and it was very interesting being involved because it was kind of the pulse of what was going on in the community. You know, we knew about all of the activities, all the politics, all the laws. That was also during the time that AIDS, we broke the story about the first cases of AIDS in Wisconsin. At the time, the public health didn't want it to keep it very much under wraps and very, you know, quiet, hush-hush about there being any cases in Wisconsin, and we would kind of regularly just say, you know, we're going to tell it like it is, you know. And so often what would happen was Out would publish something, and then the mainstream media would be forced to pick it up because, you know, the word is out there in the community, and we can't, you know, keep it silent anymore. So, you know, it was also when the stories about AIDS first started happening, people didn't know what AIDS was. You know, it was this mysterious disease. Nobody knew why, you know, anything about it. And so we published during that time. And so it was kind of regularly this news and information and research was coming out about the disease. And all of that came out through that paper. And I think we were on the leading edge of information about HIV, you know, in the state. Nobody else was talking about it. And also, you know, especially in Madison, it was the first time that there was really a public kind of, there was public information about gay lifestyle, gay culture, gay rights, you know, that, so it was very new, you know, in the 70s or before that, it really hadn't existed. If there was any kind of culture, it was very quiet and very under the radar. So that was a pretty exciting time and very interesting to be involved with that.
Was this a subscription newspaper, or was it for free? I'm just trying to imagine how you got it into people's hands.
Yeah, it was both. We offered subscription. I think we only had about 200 subscribers. There were people who didn't, either were in remote areas who couldn't get a copy of the paper, or for privacy reasons wanted to, you know, get a copy mailed to them. So we distributed 10,000 copies, and they were free copies. And then we mailed to about 200 people who paid for a subscription. Probably the bulk of, we did get some grant money, and we did have advertising. Probably the most important source was advertising revenue. But we kind of cobbled it together between the subscriptions, the kind of charitable donations and grants, You know, just a variety of source was a patchwork quilt, and that was our little bit of money that we paid staff and, you know, paid for the production of the paper.
Was it like at a grocery store or something? I'm
yes.
just okay. I'm mm-hmm. trying to imagine then. So this was the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Were people, do you think, comfortable going to the grocery store? I guess if it was free, they could just pick it up and put it in their bag, you know,
mm-hmm.
and do that privately. But do you think that was a time when people were more, you know, comfortable saying, yes, I read this magazine and I don't care if you know?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, I think in Madison, it became very well known because we had it on every newsstand that we could find in town. And so people, and back then, free papers were not quite as common as they are now. Now there's just, you know, print literature everywhere for free. But that back then there was only, you know, like the Isthmus and a few other publications, and so we really kind of stood out more. And I think in Madison it was pretty, it was a very well-known publication because it was so grassroots, you know, because it was available just everywhere and there was a lot of culture around it. I think probably in other parts of the state it was a lot more controversial. And, you know, maybe people would kind of, like, look around to make sure that nobody was looking when they grabbed a copy and ran out the door, you know. I do know we mailed them in a plain brown wrapper. And we used to just put out and then our P.O. box on it. And I think we did that with, like, a hand stamp, you know. And people complained. Some of our subscribers complained, and they said, you can't have out and your address on it. You know, that's, they said, we live in whatever, wherever it would be, like Superior, you know, Anago or somewhere in northern Wisconsin, and they said, if somebody tracks this back, if they do research, you know, if the local postmaster in this town of 200 people, you know, happens to do research and find out this is a gay publication, our house could be burned down. You know, it was a very, not that that stuff doesn't happen now, but it was a really different time, you know, that gay was a brand new thing that nobody had ever talked about, you know, in polite company, you know, so.
Right. So tell me about some other projects that you've been involved in.
So another thing that I, another organization, well-known gay organization that I was part of, was called Galvanize, and that was a Pride March. It was the organization that put on the Pride March in 89 91. Then there was a gap of a couple years, 92 and 93 there was no march, and then 94 through 98 or 99. So in a 10-year period we put on like 6 marches or something like that. In the late, I think they started organizing in 88. You know, people around the country, there were other gay marches that were happening, gay parades that were happening. And so there was enough of a community at that point that people, various people and groups and organizations said we should have a march. And the first effort was really big. And it was at least a year that they organized before they had that 89 march. But I remember lots and lots of people in the community were involved. And they had something like 50 or 75 volunteers that were putting on this event. And it was a whole week long thing. And they did it in conjunction with one of, maybe it was AIDS Network or one of the AIDS organizations in town. And I remember they brought the quilt, and they did it at the, what is that big building on campus, the where the football stadium is there.
Camp Randall.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So at that time, you know, I think that was before the Coliseum existed, or, you know, so they did it at Camp Randall. And I remember they had a huge section of the quilt on the floor, and people, And that was when the AIDS quote was first had been made and was touring the country, and so it was kind of a big deal having it here. And so there were several events during a whole week-long series of activities, and then culminating with the march. And I believe the first one had like 5,000 people. We went from the square, we maybe went around the square and down State Street, and then over to, I can't remember exactly, but I think it went down Langdon and ended up in the, what is that park that's on the lake there, where you see a lot of lakefront. And, well, anyway, so that was a big community activity for a couple years, working on this march and having it happen. And I think that first one, I'm almost positive, it was May 6th. And we thought, well, that would be late enough in the year that it will be, nice, decent weather, it'll be spring. Well, it snowed that day.
Of course it did.
And I remember standing up at the square. We started out, and the people who, there was just various people who had put energy into, I remember Richard Kilmer was there, he maybe was the leader or one of the main people. Richard works at Community Pharmacy, and he was involved, but there had been so many people involved in such a big organization of people involved, and I think everybody came up with an idea for a speaker. And so here we up were up at the square, and it was like snowing and 30 degrees out, and there's like gale force winds. You have little kids and people with AIDS and people in wheelchairs and everything. And the speeches just go on and on and on. I think it was a couple of hours worth of speeches, and people were freezing. And, a lot of a whole contingent of people started chanting, "Let's march, let's march," but the speakers just kept on going. I finally went to Richard and I said, "If you don't get this march going, it's going to be a riot. Either everybody's going to go home, because you have a 5,000 people gathered up at the square in this terrible weather, And he looked around and he said, "Oh my God, you're right." And then they started lining up people, and we finally got the march off the, But that weather was just, unpredictable and kind of amazing. And people still remember that, it was May, and it was snowing and really cold, and so that was the challenge for that march. And I think that, that was a big success, that we had that. It was, I think the first two galvanized marches, they said, were the biggest demonstrations that had happened in the state of Wisconsin. The first one was like 5,000 people, and I think the second one in 91 was like 8,000 people. And they broke records in terms of the size of crowd, that both the number of people marching and then also the amount of people that showed up to watch or participate. So, but the problem was with that march, and I was involved as a volunteer in that. I wasn't a leader in that. I was one of the people who volunteered to help with it. And the problem was that it was this big group of people and this big event and a lot of work, but there was no organization, there was no professional organization, nobody was being paid, and it there was no like kind of infrastructure or organization. And so a lot of infighting happened. And they could, I remember they would have these big community events where, 75 people would get together to discuss how they were supposed to do this march, And it would turn into kind of a, a brawl or whatever. And so after the first one, the organization collapsed. And then a new contingent of people kind of formed from the ashes and created another march, and that was the 91 march. And it was also, again, a big contingent of people and a big kind of week-long event. And after the 91 march, it fell apart again. because it was too big of a project and too many people involved to not have some sort of professional organization that was managing it. And so for 92 and 93, there was no march. And people missed it, but it was also, you know, the people who had been involved in those first two marches were like, there's people who still won't talk to each other that were involved way back, you know, like 20 years ago. And so Ben Doren, who had been involved with both of the 89 and 91 marches, had this idea that he was going to resurrect the Galvanize organization and put on another march. And in February of 94, he was at gay events, and I don't remember which ones. It was maybe the 10% Society dance or somewhere that was fairly public that a lot of people gathered. He was handing out literature and saying, you know, we're going to do another march and stuff. And I signed up, and my former partner, Alan, signed up. And Maria Hansen signed up. But then we didn't hear anything. And it was kind of like, okay, well, we're waiting for this to happen. And so finally, in like, I don't know, April or May, we had our first meeting. And it was just the four of us. It's like... So we're going to put on, and I think they had identified July as the date, that the third week in July. And I don't know why, because June is traditionally the Pride Month, you know. But I don't know whether it was like, let's do it then because Milwaukee has theirs. Or it may have been that the Magic Picnic at that time, there was a picnic called the Magic Picnic that was run by the bars. And Rodney Scheel. And so we may have attached our event to that weekend because of that existing Magic Picnic. I think that's maybe why it happened. But we had established the date, and the date, you know, so it was like, all right, well, it's May, and we need to have this march in July, you know. And I had a bunch of experience, you know, doing these kind of things, fundraising and putting together stuff. And so I said, okay, well, we need money, you know, and so let's do a house party and let's send out a mailing and let's, you know, do this publicity. And we each kind of took on a piece. I think somebody had donated a design, and so we got a t-shirt. We had Tammy Baldwin did a house party for us and raised a bunch of money. And I think she did, I think all of the years that we did the Galvanized marches in the 90s, she did a house party to raise money. And she allowed us to use her mailing list. And we sold a bunch of t-shirts, and I think we raised like $4,000 or something like that. It wasn't very much money. It was less than $5,000 for sure. but we also had to work with the police on closing off streets and getting permits and getting, you know, figuring out food and figuring out, people wanted to be vendors and various organizations wanted to march with banners. And so there was, you know, it was a bunch of organizing stuff that had to happen. And somehow I guess it was probably late April or early May, it was less than 3 months' time, we were able to get out, you know, to have the party, to raise the funds, to get out the word, to organize people, and to have this march. And the first one, 1,000 people showed up. And we were, you know, when we were doing this, we were really worried and thinking, oh my God, you know, like we've raised this money and we've done this organizing, will anybody show up? You know, we thought maybe, you know, like 20 of our friends would show up or something. And lo and behold, like 1,000 people showed up. We had it right at the top of State Street, I think we gathered. And I'm not sure, I think that first one, we didn't have enough either organizing power or money or whatever to do it on the square. So I think we just gathered right at the top of State Street, and then we marched down State Street, and I think there was some sort of entertainment afterwards, like a program or speakers or whatever. Rather than having all kinds of speeches and things at the beginning, I think we did just a little kind of welcome and rally kind of thing, and then marched, and then there were some speakers and maybe some entertainment at the end. It was pretty basic, but a lot of groups got involved, and people were really tickled that we had gotten it back, you know, that we had a Pride March going again, and that we had a pretty good showing considering how little time and money and effort had gone into it. So then it was like, well, we had a success. What are we going to do next year? You know, and so I think, you know, the 95 March was then bigger and a little bit more well organized. And what we realized was the downfall of the first organization was it was too big. They got too many people involved and there wasn't enough structure. And it turned into chaos and turned into, you know, some warring going on. So our idea was to keep the organizing team kind of lean and mean, you know, like I think we had less than 10 people that put on the march, and each person would have, you know, I'm going to deal with the vendors and I'm going to deal with the permits, and, you know, everybody had kind of one area that they were going to work on. And at that time, I worked at Wisconsin Community Fund, and Wisconsin Community Fund would act as a fiscal sponsor for small groups that didn't have a 501c3 status and were, you know, just kind of an emerging organization that didn't, but wanted to have the nonprofit ability for people to either get grants or individuals to make contributions. And so I believe in those first years that Wisconsin Community Fund acted as the fiscal sponsor organization. And in 96, Ralph Obedahl who is a self-proclaimed minister in Wisconsin, I think he's from Monroe, kind of right-wing religious person, although he's not ordained by anybody and he has this church, which is not a real church, but he was very active in being anti-gay, and he was also very active in in being anti-abortion, and so those were his kind of two political prongs, and he was making a lot of noise in 96, and protesting at gay events, and, you know, and like kind of barring people from going into events and doing all, you know, stuff in the paper kind of regularly about him and his kind of anti-gay message. So that ended up being like a really good organizing tool, because people were really, you know, the gay community was really kind of angry about him and that he was being so visible and getting a fair amount of attention. And we did a project where we had, I don't know how many people it was probably like 100 people, and we got t-shirts made in 6 different rainbow colors, and people would all buy a t-shirt, and then they were like a big choir or whatever, you know, and so then we lined them up on the Capitol steps so that they were, you could see visibly the rainbow colors. And we tried to have people of color and young people, old people, you know, people with disabilities, like also a rainbow of people, men, women, involved in this. And there was a picture, photo that was taken of that, and it was on the front page of the State Journal, which kind of really rallied people. And then, back then, the Isthmus was pretty cheap to advertise in. So I said, I found out what it was to advertise, to buy the back cover of the Isthmus. And it was like $1,500 or something like that. And then, you know, the Isthmus had, even back then, their publication was at least 50,000 copies a week. And so I said, let's do that. And so we did a big full page, tabloid size page thing about the march, and inviting people to come to the march. And so between people coming out because of, I think in that particular march, a lot of our fellow travelers, like people, Native American rights activists and people with disabilities and environmentalists, even people who are not usually involved in gay rights, came out because of Ovidal and just kind of wanting to make a statement that of support and kind of unity. And so we had 5,000 people again at that march. I think it was the biggest one. That one, and then the first two were the very largest demonstrations that we had. And the message of that one was kind of a lot more political, a show of kind of political power. I think there were five people from Ovidal's church that showed up. So they were outnumbered 1,000 to 1 or something like that, And that particular march, was CNN covered it. And I remember we finished the march and we were just dead tired. There was a kind of a show afterwards. And then we all went out to eat. I can't remember where, some pizza place. And they had a TV on and CNN was showing footage of that march. And it was just, we were all just floored to see that we made international news, so that was really cool. And I think then it was so 97, probably either 97 or 98. I was kind of getting burned out. I was kind of doing double time with my regular job and then also trying to keep up with the march activity. And there was somebody else, who was an individual in the community that kind of stepped forward and said that he would take it over. And so it then became Madison Pride. It changed. And I don't remember whether that was 97 or 98 or 99, somewhere in that time period, it morphed from being Galvanize and became Madison Pride. And I think the bars, several of the bars, threw in some money and some time and energy, and it became a little bit more focused on bars and kind of businesses, rather than it had been more kind of a nonprofit volunteer community kind of effort before. But I was involved with that for probably the better part of a decade, was involved with Galvanize.
What was the purpose of the marches?
Well, one thing that we realized was that visibility was really important. That if people thought, oh, well, there's just a handful of gay people in Madison, and they really don't, have much clout, it's just a few nuts that are out there, that it was pretty easy to dismiss us. But the idea, and the thing was that if we were at the bars, or even if we went to the Magic Picnic, was always held in Brittingham Park, and there would be hundreds or maybe even thousands of people that would come to that picnic. But it was not very visible. It didn't get coverage on TV. It did, it was a big party, but mainstream society didn't really know. And so the idea was, if 5,000 people or 8,000 people marched down State Street, on a nice July day on a Sunday, when there's all the shoppers out, and we made local, statewide, or national news. People realize this is a real, there is a really significant community here. There is a population of people. They're organized, they're active, they took us seriously. So Galvanize was Gay and Lesbian Visibility Alliance. So that was the whole idea, was to be more visible, show a kind of a unified group, that we were. that we were a large group and we were well organized enough to gather that many people and have. So it was partly about celebration, but it was also to say to the world, we're here, you know. And we have the same rights as everybody else, and we need to be taken seriously.
You mentioned Ovidal, and his five supporters. do you think that in 96 he was kind of a lone figure in the community, or did other people in the community support his message?
I think there was a contingent of people who supported his message. I think probably more in outlying areas, in smaller towns. I always thought that he was really bogus because he was not an ordained minister. His church was not recognized by anybody. I think it came out at one point that he didn't even have a nonprofit organization that was behind it, that they were raising money and illegally, or you know, that there was no real organization. It was just him preaching kind of anti-gay stuff in his garage. That was, and so I mean, if it had been a real religious organization and he was a real religious leader, I always thought that we needed to expose the fact that it's just some guy that has an anti-gay opinion and he's calling himself a church so that he can, you know, spread his anti-gay message. Some people did listen, and some people did think, you know, agree with him, or you know, give him some credence. I think a lot of people thought that he was pretty shady, or you know, not very reputable. I think very similar to what's the organization from the Westboro Baptist Church and Fred Phelps, nationally has been well known for that kind of anti-gay rhetoric and that kind of thing. Ovidal is more of a local version of that.
Okay.
At least with Fred Phelps, he has a, you know, kind of a real religious organization behind him. With Ovidal, it was just, you know, it was a phony church, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. But there were people that took him seriously, and I think, you know, I think the more conservative elements didn't want to hear a gay rights message and didn't want, maybe didn't want us to see us on TV or see that we, I think that people have, often when people don't want to recognize that we are like a political or a social force or whatever, will say that we're a special interest group or, you're wanting special rights or, you know, that kind of thing, you know, and I don't see it that way.
I might be jumping around a little bit, but the 96 March was about 15 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there's more, I guess, could someone like Ovidal happen in 2010?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think especially now, because, you know, with this most recent election, it was a real kind of turn to the right. And there are progressive churches that support gay rights and welcome open and affirming or welcoming congregations. There's lots of them in Madison. But there's still a lot of churches, including, you know, the Catholic Church, some big, you know, really big churches that are openly anti-gay and say that it's a sin and, you know, that, you know, it depends on how far to the right they are, but some of them just say it's a sin. Some of them say that we're going to hell or that, you know, that we should be killed, or, you know, it depends on how radical they are. But yeah, there, it's very possible that that someone like Ralph Ovedal would kind of, you know, get in the limelight again.
In Madison, or because Madison, yeah, you know, has a tradition of being very, very liberal and very, yeah, open.
Yeah, I think in Madison, you know, Bishop Morlino has been very conservative and very, very much anti-gay. He's not the kind of person that's out like Ovedal is kind of shouting from the rooftops, you know. But when there have been regular anti-gay stuff from the Catholic Church, for example, you know, just recently there was that flap right around the election where the Lieutenant Governor Clefish had made that statement that, you know, domestic partnership was like marrying your dog or your furniture, you know. And got a lot of flack for it, but still she said that and she got elected as lieutenant governor. So, you know, I think it's more possible now than it has been for quite a while. It seems like the, you know, the political pendulum has swung to the right. And then, unfortunately, it seems like a lot of right-wing people are, you know, that's part of the message is anti-gay.
Are you, does that concern you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course.
Silly question on my part.
I mean, I think that, well, for example, the last governor was very pro-gay rights, Governor Doyle, and we had the domestic partnership registry, and he also had state employees are able to get domestic partner benefits. Happened during his administration, although we also, during his administration, we had the constitutional amendment that made marriage between a man and a woman, so it was kind of a mixed bag, but he didn't really have any, you know, he was opposed to that amendment, but it passed anyway. But I can see, you know, like a new administration, conservative administration, wanting to get rid of those policies, try to, you know, to get those repealed. So
do you think that it could happen?
Yeah, I think it's possible, especially because, you know, now we have the legislature has turned to a Republican majority, and they have a Republican governor, so they've got a little bit more of a carte blanche in terms of law. Having and often I've noticed that often Democrats don't go lockstep with the party. They're a little bit more free thinkers and go on both sides of the aisles, whereas it seems the Republicans are extremely loyal, and they, you know, like they vote in a block and they vote, you know, every time, you know, so they have as much clout as possible. So, you know, it's entirely possible. I think that over time, and we've seen this over the last 20 years, that the culture and society and the political, legal stuff is changing towards gay rights. And sometimes there's a step forward and then two steps back, or two steps forward and one step back. But we keep seeing, you know, that there's more rights and more. And it is the civil rights issue of our time. I mean, it's played out every day in the courts, in the newspapers, in gay stories are up in almost every day. You can read something about a gay, either positive or negative, you know, a law that's passed, or people who are protesting that, or, you know, the negative incidents that have happened with people getting, you know, gay bashing or whatever, but it's very, very much up in the news. And it, you know, one thing that I've talked with a lot of gay people about this, and it's like, it's no longer politically correct or socially acceptable to be racist. It's no longer politically or socially acceptable to, you know, to treat people with disabilities poorly. You know, it's no longer acceptable to be anti-Semitic, but it's still okay to be anti-gay, you know, very loudly, publicly, and people, you know, accept it and think it's all right. So we have a ways to go yet.
Well, it kind of brings me to my next question then. If we could look back a little bit, is there a specific issue that you've seen change the most over your lifetime?
Specific, you mean like apolitical or?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think probably gay rights has been the thing that, or gay rights and culture has changed the most in my lifetime of any area that I'm aware of. And I think that a lot of that has to do, I mean, you can pass laws, but laws aren't everything. In other words, that judges can still ignore those laws or you know, interpret them the way that they choose. Or law enforcement people can, you know, choose to ignore that law or not to prosecute or whatever. But I think that the thing that has really changed is culture. And I think that's partly because of media. And I think it's partly because of people coming out. In other words, like before 1970 or before 1980, anybody that was gay was closeted and in fear for, you know, if they came out, they would risk their lives, or their job or their whatever. since 1980, more and more people have come out, and because of that, it seems like everybody has either a coworker or a brother, an uncle, cousin, you know, somebody they've known in their life that is gay. And then it's not so much like a boogeyman that lives, you know, halfway around the world. It isn't just that culture that, you know, is in San Francisco and their flamboyant marches that happen once a year, you know. It's a real person that's within their sphere of influence and that they have a real relationship with. And I think that has changed people's attitudes and ideas about gay people more than probably anything. You know, that kind of influence of knowing someone, knowing a real person that's in your life that's gay, and then it, you know, then it becomes more acceptable, or you know, that's and also it takes away from the stigma a bit. I think there's still stigma, but that is. Being gay is one of the possibilities. Not that, you know, you're a criminal or, you know, some kind of deviant or crazy person, you know. So I think that's had a huge effect. And I think the laws have changed people's attitudes. I remember hearing on Wisconsin Public Radio one time, they were talking about gay rights and whether people it was during the constitutional amendment debate, and this man called from northern Wisconsin, it was north of Green Bay, he identified, he said, well, I'm really not in favor of marriage, of gay marriage, but he said, of course gay people should, you know, should have the same rights as other people in terms of being able to have a job and, you know, like not be discriminated in terms of housing, and, you know, he lists, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, and he identified himself as somebody that was a conservative Republican and said, well, of course they should have equal rights. Well, that's a big change, you know, from 20 years ago or so. But I think the media has also really changed things. And for example, Ellen. You know, Ellen coming out on TV. She had a popular TV sitcom show. And then, you know, everybody kind of knew that she was gay. At least all gay people knew that she was gay. But, you know, then she came out and there was a, you know, part of her show where she had a partner or a girlfriend. The reason that she came out was that she was dating this person. And, you know, I remember at the time it was like, oh, that's the end of her show. Then it'll be canceled. And it wasn't, you know, like it continued to be popular. And then she became, you know, really well-known comedian and talk show host and hostess. And so there's that, you know, shows like Will and Grace, I think were really groundbreaking. And I think that that has kind of also normalized being gay, or even kind of popularized it. It was kind of cool to be gay, or, you know, cool to be hip enough that you would accept gay people as, you know, as friends or whatever. So I think that that culture has been, the media has been helpful. There's kind of a downside to that too, which is a lot of people who don't really know very much about gay people think that we're all like Will, you know, like we're all kind of white, young, good-looking lawyers, you know, wealthy. You know, there is that negative stereotype that's out there, you know, which we run into sometimes because we're fundraising, you know, and we're trying to say there's real problems in the gay community, and it's not just kind of political, legal problems. It's that gay people tend to have more health problems than the average, you know, the general population, and they tend to have less money, less resources to be able to deal with those health challenges. And, you know, and people that have that stereotype that we're all, you know, wealthy white lawyers, male, well, you know, why do you need, you know, gay people are all rich and white, you know, like, why do you need anything? So
it's interesting that you say that, though, because I would have imagined that the stereotype would have been Will's friend, Jack, who was okay. More flamboyant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's another negative stereotype mm-hmm. that would come from that show is, you know, somebody that was really campy and kind of nutty and off the wall and, you know, promiscuous or, you know, like whatever else. There was lots of kind of negative attributes that he had. Or I guess people liked him because he was so outrageous, you know, but a lot of parts of his personality would be, you know, seen as negative. So, yeah, I think that they're both exist, you know. One of the things that we struggle with in the gay community and that we've been working on here is the division between people of color and white people and the kind of notion that because a lot of the gay rights organizing and gay rights culture that have happened over the last 20 years have been in the white community. And so it's, you know, it's kind of seen as a white phenomenon. And because of religious beliefs and cultural beliefs in communities of color, often homosexuality is even more taboo than it is in white culture. And so, and there's the phenomenon that if somebody is a person of color and they're also gay, then it's kind of a double whammy, you know? And so often it's easier for them to stay in the closet, especially in their community of color. And, you know, that has a lot of negative repercussions.
So you talked kind of about the progress that we've made as a culture. Is there an LGBT issue that you've seen not change at all in the last 20 or so years?
Well, you know, in the early days when I was first doing this work, it was lesbian and gay. And often there was lesbian and there was gay. you know, like especially in the 80s, there, at least in Madison, there was a real big division between the women's community and the men's community. And there was a, you know, back then, even more than now, there was a kind of a separatist movement within the women's community. And so didn't want to work with men. And I think it went the other way too, like, you know, with men, like wanting to hang out with men and not associate with women. But bisexuality was not on the radar back in the 70s, 80s, you know, even 90s. Bi was not part of that equation. And transgender was way out there, you know. And I think that both of those, the B and the T, are still kind of tacked on. I think that the bisexual community is kind of invisible a lot, is not very cohesive, it kind of isn't welcome in the gay community and isn't welcome in the straight community, you know, kind of without a country or whatever. And yeah, and mostly invisible. And I think there's also the with bisexuality, there's the problem of the kind of Larry Craig syndrome, of that a lot of so-called straight men who are bisexual are closeted, and the only time they have sex is through anonymous experiences, anonymous clandestine experiences. And so trying to organize around that or have any kind of community is almost impossible. With transgender people, I think that, you know, we're the transgender community is probably where the gay community was in like 1970, you know, when Stonewall first happened, in terms of people understanding it or accepting it, or, you know, the transgender people and culture that I've come to know because of my work with outreach, is kind of the most marginalized, the most repressed, the most challenged kind of financially. There's, you know, so it seems like that's an area that we, you know, that we haven't made a lot of progress on. And the gay rights law that happened in 1982 that David Clarenbaugh authored, that was lesbian and gay. And bi was kind of part of it by extension. In other words, that if you were a bi man and you were having sex with men, that kind of, even though you were bisexual, it kind of, you were under that umbrella. Transgender was never included. And I think that David tried to get transgender included, and he just didn't have the political support for doing that. When we did that law, it was the first one in the US. So we were way on the cutting edge of with that law, and now we're kind of way behind the curve because lots of other places in the U.S. have passed laws, the gay rights laws, and a lot of them have passed transgender protection as well. The T has been added, you know, when those laws were created, and we've never added the T in Wisconsin. I believe Madison and Dane County both have transgender laws that protect transgender people, give transgender people equality, at least legally. Supposedly they have. I'm not sure that it really translated into reality or not, but at least on the books, transgender people do in Dane County and in Madison, and I believe in Milwaukee County. But the rest of the state, you know, it's still completely possible to fire somebody for being transgender, you know, to kick them out of housing, etc., you know, because of their gender identity. So that's a place where there's still kind of a lot of need, and that organizing in that area is still kind of in its infancy.
So then, looking forward, what do you think might change the most or the least? over the next 20 or so years?
In terms of gay rights and culture, or just things in general?
Just an LGBT issue in general.
Well, I think when I did some door knocking for Fair Wisconsin with the constitutional rights, or the constitutional amendment, and so talked to a bunch of people in some middle-class neighborhoods and some upper-class neighborhoods, and, you know, just kind of walking down the street, knocking on doors. And what we discovered, and it was, you know, people found this just generally across the state, is that people under 50 were much more likely to be pro-gay and to support gay marriage, and people over 50 were much less likely to. And so I think that part of it is a generational thing, and that eventually, as the is my generation and my parents' generation, you know, die off, that the younger generation doesn't seem to be nearly as, I mean, they don't care that much, you know, it just doesn't seem like a big deal. Like, well, why wouldn't they have, why wouldn't they be able to marry, you know? So I think that will be a big change. And again, it's kind of more cultural and societal. Again, you know, you can legislate laws, but I think that the culture and social norms actually have a bigger impact, because it's what people think and the way that they treat each other, and it's not necessarily dictated by laws. So I think that's going to be the big change.
Do you think there's anything that won't change? We'll still be talking about it 20 years from now?
Well, I think that the gay rights movement is a pretty young movement. And so I don't think that within the next 20 years that it's going to be completely, you know, accepted, and there won't be any issue, and there won't be any difference between gay people and straight people. Just because the movement is pretty young, and it seems like there's still a fairly long way to go. And, you know, when you think about the civil rights movement that happened in the 60s, and there was a long, probably more than 100 years of work organizing, things that happened around race before that, you know, there's still a long way to go in terms of people of color having the same rights, the same opportunities, as white people. So I don't think that it's going to be absolutely equal, and people are going to be, you know, not notice the difference between gay people and straight people. I think it'll be less than it is now.
Okay. Well, we kind of got on this conversation while we were talking about the Pride March and things. So I just want to go back and see if there was any other kind of activist opportunity or things that you did that you wanted to mention before we kind of end.
Well, I had kind of another whole career that was had to do with organizing. And that was, I worked for Wisconsin Community Fund for almost 20 years. No, it was 20 years. Wisconsin Community Fund is a foundation that gives grants to social change and social justice organizations. And I got involved because of my gay rights work. And I thought, well, this is a really cool organization, because it was a whole array of people, you know, farmers and Native Americans and environmentalists, and, you know, just a broad communities of color were involved, a broad spectrum of kind of progressive thinking people. And we were a funding agency, so we didn't actually do the work. We weren't out kind of doing the demonstrations or doing the workshop through the media or whatever. We were funding it, so doing fundraising and grant making around it. But I got to, I had relationships with groups and people all over the state for that 20-year period. And that was, it kind of really broadened my horizons in terms of in terms of knowing what was going on in all parts of the state in 17 different issue areas. You know, gave me a much broader kind of vision of than just the more narrow gay rights. And I think that, you know, way back at the beginning of our conversation today, I was talking about the civil rights movement, the 60s, the anti-war. I've kind of continued that thread through, you know, through my whole life in terms of activism. This period of my life, I'm more focusing in on the gay issues and through my job and also through my activity in the community. But we are part of Community Shares of Wisconsin Workplace Giving Campaign, which is also a social justice kind of consortium of organizations. So kind of regularly rub shoulders with people who are doing work in domestic violence and environment and, you know, just a whole broad range of topics. so that is, you know, like another whole set of stuff I have done. And one thing I really like about that is that it seems like if we all work together, that we can get farther than if each of us are in our own little silo, you know, and that we're working on our one issue and we're not thinking about fellow travelers or not thinking about other kind of like-minded organizations, you know. I think there could be more kind of cooperation between various kind of progressive groups. And a lot of times progressive groups don't think of including gay. People think either it's more, think of gay people more as a cultural thing or, you know, the entertainment or that kind of thing rather than like a political movement or something like that. So that's an area that I haven't talked about, but I was involved with for a long time and I'm still involved with kind of tangentially.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we are talking much longer than I expected that we would, which is not a bad thing, but I just looked at my watch and said, my goodness, we've been talking for a while.
And I have a work study student that's coming in so that I have to get going too.
Okay, but is there anything before we turn off the recorder that you wanted to make sure that we mentioned?
No, I don't think so. I think we covered a lot of ground today.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.